You're with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk TNT.
Good morning and welcome to Thursday on the Sonia Poulton Show on today's News Talk. It is absolutely wonderful, as ever, to have you with us wherever you find us, whether that is on X or Instagram or on YouTube or Rumble or a multitude of other platforms where you can find us, or right here on TNT. Good morning to you all out there. Wonderful, as ever, as I say, to have you with us. On today's show, we ask if Labour's plans to renationalise the railways will get the nation back on track. And we attempt to find out why England is the worst in the world for underage drinking. And we also celebrate a huge victory for democracy, free speech and human rights. So I'm looking forward to all of those things coming up. Now, convicted child killer Lucy Letby has renewed her appeal, and it's in the High Court in London this week, including today. Lucy Letby, of course, was convicted of murdering seven babies and attempting to murder six others at the Countess of Cheshire Hospital. The former neonatal nurse is serving 14 whole life prison terms after being found guilty of the offences last year. Letby had applied for leave to appeal against the convictions shortly after the trial ended in August. She was refused that permission. She's now asking senior High Court judges to allow her an appeal. She appeared on Monday via a video link from HMP Bronzefield Prison in Surrey. Separately, Letby is due to face a retrial on one count of attempted murder at Manchester Crown Court from 10th of June. There are reporting restrictions in place because Letby's appeal hearing, there are reporting restrictions in place because of the future charge that she's facing. And this is to avoid, of course, potentially prejudicing jurors and finding oneself in contempt of court, which is never a good thing. So I will just say this. A couple of months ago, I was contacted by a viewer who suggested I should speak with a doctor who had questioned the convictions. It turned out the doctor was operating under an anonymous identity for fear of repercussions. We began speaking and he agreed to not only come on the show, but to waive his identity at the same time, stand up and be counted, as it were. I contacted him recently to arrange for him to come and talk about his research, and silence. I followed that up and silence. I let the viewer know I had heard nothing. After such a promising start, the viewer contacted him. Guess what followed? Silence. So we often ask our viewers to let us know who they would like us to speak with. So if you are interested in the case and you have a favourite person who's commenting on the case with some credibility, please let me know and I will follow that up as a future potential guest. And also, I mentioned at the start of the week that the captured National Physical Laboratory had the pride flag outside of the building forever. And following the CAS review, that had been replaced with an MPL flag. Well, I walked past yesterday after the show and there was a George Cross now flapping in the wind. And it seems like now that they finally got past the whole rainbow thing, they're prepared to explore other demographics in the world, and not before time. Now, our question of the day is, after Labour vows to renationalise most rail services within 5 years, we ask, what other services would you like to see under state control? And you can call us. Here are the numbers. UK 0330 024 1026. If you're dialing from US and Canada, 1-888-201-6427. And if you're dialing from Australia and New Zealand, 1-800-673-310. And we put this question on X and the comments are already flooding in thick and fast. So the question is, of course, what other services would you like to see under state control? And Penelope on X says the government, which is fairly hilarious. Angie says water. Medwin says gas, electricity and water. And Steve says, none, to be honest, no governments or politicians can be trusted. I'd love to see the NHS belong to the people again who pay for it, though. And so say all of us. And on that note, let's find out what's going on with the UK headlines from Gemma Cooper.
Connecting the dots, painting the bigger picture.
They always have great conversation.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome in, Gemma. How are you this glorious Thursday?
You know, I was wondering on the comments how many people would say, none, I don't want anything under government control. You know, I think we've seen quite enough government control over the last 4 years and have woken up to the reality of everything. So it'd be interesting. We've got a different demographic in our audience, very switched on to what's really going on. So let's see the percentage that say nothing. Nothing under state control. We're all sovereign beings. I think there's going to be plenty of those in your X question, I think.
Please, miss. Julia says none of them. They should be like, literally, this has just come in. They should be like a cooperative run by the people, not for profit. We can't trust government or corporations to tax. They cheat, lie, pollute and overcharge. There you go. I think that completely backs up what you're saying. Yes, I suspect we're going to get a few of those.
Yeah,
we're going to get a few
will.
Of those. It's tricky, isn't it? People have just lost faith. I mean, just lost faith. That's the bottom line, really, isn't it?
It is. And that's why this is a top headline today. You know, Labour pledging to bring back the rail network under public ownership. Well, they've captured the mood of the public. I think we'll talk about that one in a minute, because that headline is absolutely everywhere. And it's broken, beleaguered Britain, you know, taking your life into your hands on public transport. You never get anywhere on time, getting to the post office, queuing at the post office. I mean, it is literally sometimes like the most depressing thing you can do, venture foot outside your door just to access some services. But anyway, that's the top headline of the day at the moment, the pledge by Labour to renationalise most of the UK rail service. Also, a story that broke yesterday while I was on air at TNT, a girl has now been arrested in South Wales after a pupil and a teacher were injured in a stabbing incident. The girl's in year 9. And also, we do so many stories about the police, but this one, police in Scotland could be facing a misconduct inquiry after they failed to spot that a murder victim had actually been shot. They just missed it. So they're possibly going to be hauled before their chiefs. But I think it is the rail service that deserves a bit of attention. It is our question of the day, after all. And it affects millions of us here in the UK, who some of us are frankly sick of the service, if you can even call it that at the moment.
Absolutely. Let's go in on it then, Gemma. What is going on there?
Well, Labour have pledged to bring most of the train services back into public control. A lot of them actually were kind of effectively taken back by the government during the scamdemic, interestingly enough. And the government has already set up its planned Great British Railway public sector body, which it would oversee. And Labour are taking it one step further and saying, right, we would make that not overseen by government, the Great British Rail Network. Echoes there if you're a certain age. Of British Rail, which is when you and I were kids, it was British Rail, wasn't it? It was in public ownership. Yeah. But they're saying they would have this Great British Railway service, but it would be overseen by somebody who actually knows about trains and not just a government watchdog. And they would keep a small role for some private sector companies, some small companies, open line, open access services that run small local networks in certain parts of the country. They said there is a role for those services. They can stay under private ownership, a bit like small local taxi companies, effectively, but trains. Also, they say that they would absolutely issue refunds for delayed services. Well, I've been on the trains quite a bit over the last few years. That would be a lot of refunds, let me assure you. And also, they say they will have better internet access on the train networks. It's been kind of a mixed response to this. Conservatives are saying, well, you haven't got enough money to pay for it. You'll have to raise taxes. Labour are saying, we won't raise taxes. We know what we're doing. We will kind of effectively take the model that you've created, the Great British Railway Network, but we would let train companies, train experts rather, oversee it. Rail firms are saying today that nationalisation is a political solution, not a practical one, and that the government already, with its newly formed Great British Railway watchdog, is interfering too much, and they wouldn't want any more government control. Interestingly, the rail unions, Mick Lynch, there's still train strikes going on. The next bank holiday here in the UK, we're facing a rail strike, more disruption. Mick Lynch, chair of the RMT, he welcomes this news, but he says everything should be back into public ownership. There shouldn't be a mix of private and public. And that would be the first step that he would go down. We're looking at sorting out our beleaguered railway system. But anyone, if you're listening or watching and you've tried the trains in the UK, it's a disaster area. You never know when they're going to turn up. You never know if you're going to get in on time. You have to factor in delays into your journey. Third world countries like India have better train services than the UK. It is in a mess. There's no two ways about it. But this is an easy vote winner. And of course, Labour aren't in power yet. It's easy to say anything when you're the opposition party. You can say what you like if you think it might get you the votes. And then once you're in, of course, kind of forgot about that. It's gone away. You know how politics works, Sonia. You know, let's get the headlines. Let's get the votes. Let's get into power. And then we'll see what really happens.
That's exactly what it feels like to me. This is one of those, oh, this would look like a vote winner type of thing, because people know we're disgruntled with our railway services. It's absolutely ridiculous. And they're scandalously expensive as well, on top of everything else. It's cheaper to fly to another country for the most part than travel from one end of the UK to another. Even just to go like to from London to Liverpool or London to Manchester is hellishly expensive. We're talking can be hundreds of pounds. And that's not just to be in first class, just depending on the day and which network it is. So people are deeply disgruntled. I love traveling on the train, Gemma. I really enjoy a train journey. I just hate everything that comes along with it. When we went on a train recently, there were like train marshals. I'd never seen them before. And they had the right to fine you there and then if you didn't have the correct tickets. And they were actually dressed up like military personnel. It was really interesting. I'd never seen anything like it before. But we shall see. Yes, this does sound a bit like a PR stunt. And Labour are full of these, aren't they, oftentimes? And they're so desperate to get back into office, of course. And the Tories have now become so unpopular that these sort of things, for me, just shriek, here's a vote winner, let's say it. And whether it materialises or not is a whole other story.
I think so. And also, we have seen over the last 4 years what government control really looks like.
What is or not is a whole other story.
I think so. And also, we have seen over the last 4 years what government control really looks like, what it really looks like, and what will it really look like should they take over the transport system? You know, if you apply our kind of Agenda 2030 logic to this, which if you're listening, I think you probably will. What one of the things that's within that is restriction of movement. So if you renationalize everything and it becomes under government ownership, government can effectively control it, switch it off. Oh, there's no trains today. You can't travel. Stay in your smart city zones. In fact, we're not going to have trains anymore. We'll have these smart things. You know, that's also a sinister side. You could call it conspiratorial, or you could say it's a possibility. I think it is a possibility. Once government controls something, they control something. And we have all seen where that's led us down the last 4 years.
Well, I mean, that's the reality. We're not even in the realm of conspiracy theory anymore. We have firmly planted ourselves into the realm of conspiracy fact. There are conspiracies happening around us and towards us, and that is significantly and seriously happening. And no, we cannot trust government. But I suppose there's this element, Gemma, where I kind of hark back to my childhood when everything seemed so much better run. But I'm not convinced that it was. That might just be, you know, rose-coloured specs. But either way, the railways, as it stands, is an untenable situation because the prices go up. I travelled from where I live in southwest London across to southeast London. Cost me £21 on Sadiq Khan's transport and also using other networks as well. It should never cost that much. I remember when I first moved to London at 18, you could get a weekly pass for something like £3.50. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. I don't even know how we can afford to live anymore in this world, Gemma. How can people even afford to travel to work anymore?
Well, people can't. I mean, it is as simple as that. People can't afford the basics. People are in record levels of debt in the UK. It's a strange predicament we find ourselves in, that we seem to be akin to now a third world country in terms of the gap between the haves and the have-nots, rich and poor, the levels of services we can access, our health service, our transport service. Anyone who's travelled, you know, this is what a third world country looks like. The haves and the have-nots, the gulf is bigger, and the actual day-to-day living conditions are a struggle. That's effectively what a third world country is. We're not far off that in terms of, I don't want to be too bleak, but England, Britain, things did used to run properly. I'm not saying let's hark back to the 70s. There are also control of the unions. The unions did have too much power and needed reform.
Yes.
They needed reform, the unions. Anyone of a certain age will remember that. They didn't need crushing, which is what happened. You know, the government's crushed the unions. So now there's no work, hardly any workers' rights. You know, working is a much more difficult thing if you're on the bottom of the rung of the ladder. So the way that our society's gone, and we'll just go take it back to the trains. You know, you and I are very similar age. The trains did used to run, and remember the lovely carriages we used to have, and the very 1950-esque, and the guard would come and give you your ticket. There was none of this ticket offices closing everywhere. You'd get a ticket from a human being. It wouldn't be done on a smart card. You know, there is an argument for bringing the humanity back into travel, because some of the best journeys I've ever had in my entire life have been local train journeys in the UK, traveling up north when I was at university from the south. So a long 4 or 5 hour train journey. I had met some of the most interesting people, had the most interesting conversations,
yes,
but I still remember them from my 20s. Let's try and bring the humanity back into travel. Let's try.
Oh, I love the sound of that. I think that is a positive note. We will see you in the next hour. We'll be right back.
Los Angeles has been described as a suburb looking for a city. Join me as we explore LA's neighbourhoods and the local restaurants, cafes and bars that are an integral part of these vibrant and diverse communities.
Today we are going to cook a small steak for people who are really quite hungry.
Very, very simple. A couple squeezes of lemon in there.
Since you're adding the meat, and you can do also do it with tofu options as well for the vegetarians.
Olive oil. So now we're going to season it up. Fresh grind black pepper.
Really hot and busy in here.
I'm going to go ahead and make some butter toast.
Olive oil.
Ah, smells, really smells good.
Grab our shiitake mushrooms.
Season with salt a little bit.
Boy, it's getting hot in the kitchen. Need another drink of my beer. Ah, that's the best part of cooking.
And we are ready to put our plate together.
Add the mussels right around the rim. See, we have really nice colors, nice piece of fish.
We just need to add a little bit of powdered sugar.
And I will just put a little bit of reduction glaze over the top.
When you add a pesto like this onto a braised meat, the smells that just come up are just wonderful. Take it from me, we've got a good thing going here.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands, heal our waters, and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. But every day we lose more of the places we love, and we urgently need to save endangered lands, waters, and wild species. The actions we take today will determine the tomorrow we leave to our children and grandchildren. The water they drink, the air they breathe, the beauty they experience. To learn more about how you can help protect and conserve our beautiful world, visit nature.org today.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
We are always desperately looking for good news to bring you, and I may just have some in a huge victory for democracy, free speech, and human rights, a binding agreement with the WHO, which would have seen them be able to overrule governments and dictate policy in any future pandemic, has been dropped. One of those people who's been campaigning against this policy is Molly Kingsley, executive founder of Us for Them. Molly, when we say has been dropped, has it actually? And good morning to you.
good morning, Sonia. I think we need to be a bit careful here. So it looks like fantastic news. It is, however, only interim. So what has happened is a draft of these dreaded IHR, the amendments to the international health regulations, a draft of those was first published about a year and a half ago now, and it contained a whole host of really quite offensive and very problematic provisions, you know, problematic for free speech, for human rights, for public health, problematic because they purported to give the World Health Organization these binding and very sweeping powers over, it looked like, national governments. Now, those negotiations on that draft have been going on for a year and a half. There has been vanishingly little in press about it, and the WHO itself has not really done a very good job at updating the public. For the first time in a year and a half, an interim draft of this document was released just at the beginning of this week. And it is safe to say that as that draft currently stands, the majority, if not all, actually, of the really worst provisions are either gone, deleted altogether, or very significantly watered down. Now, what does that mean? First of all, it may mean nothing. It may be illusionary because this is just an interim draft. The last round of meetings on this text are ongoing this week. So, you know, we will have to see and wait to see what the final document says. They may row back on some of these provisions, they may not. Second, and I think it's really important to remember that, you know, the problems with the World Health Organization go beyond this document. So these proposals never should have been suggested. Let's be very clear on that. Yes. And some of the provisions were genuinely shocking. But they, of course, speak to a wider issue, and that is to really a failed and terribly conflicted organization. And all the questions that I know, Sonia, you have, I have, many others have about the nature of that organization, who is it serving, who is it funded by, you know, what are its driving forces, what are the influence of the pharmaceutical industry, of other states, all of those questions remain.
They do indeed. And I was reading your tweet, but it is a massive climb down, whichever way you look at it. I absolutely take your point. We have to be cautious, but it is still a very interesting and significantly massive climb down. And all of the things that you've stated, really important here. So in your opinion, what do you feel is the most significant of these issues that they appear to be dropping?
I think for me, I think there's three. It is a massive climb down, Sonia. You're right.
Massive.
And actually, you know, I think we've been getting a little bit annoyed with various people attacking us on, you know, on social media. How dare you suggest it's all okay? Well, we're not suggesting that, but it is a huge climb down and we should be really proud of that. There've not been many wins in the last few years, and this has been one of them, it looks like. I think for me, the three main things are, first of all, the original draft of these amendments had suggested to give the World Health Organization binding power to direct the action of member states. That has been dropped. So the WHO, as it always has done, can issue advisory recommendations. It cannot issue binding edicts over sovereign states. It never should have been suggested. The second point, and I think probably the kind of low watermark of the entire document for me, was the reference to the primacy of dignity, human rights, and fundamental freedoms had actually been deleted. I mean, literally struck out in the original amendment and replaced with a far more waffly, nebulous idea of cohesion and equity. That deletion has been dropped. So the reference to the primacy of dignity, human rights, fundamental freedoms stands. Thank you. And then the final thing, I think, which is interesting, is that the proposals which would have effectively turbocharged the WHO and ordained it as a global health censorship agency, they have been largely dropped. I mean, there are still, and this is a pattern of this document, there are still problematic provisions. Many of those, it's important to say, go back to 2005 when the original document was put, you know, was agreed. There was never any suggestion that a lot of these legacy provisions were going to change. So, you know, what was in question here? There was never going to be a watering down of this agreement. It was always about strengthening it and giving the WHO more powers. And that is really where we've seen the change. So the WHO's position is not significantly strengthened above the powers it already had from 2005. Now, there's a whole different conversation about whether it should have those powers at all.
Exactly. But going back to what you said at the start, Molly, and I think it is particularly egregious that the mainstream media, legacy media, has failed to report on this throughout, because this has been a cause of very serious concern for people who have been aware of it. And one of the things that has seriously concerned people is this idea that our sovereignty can be taken away from us for this centralized power at the WHO. But that's not now going to happen, right?
No, I mean, it doesn't look like it. As I say, and I don't want to sound too caveated, but we will, you know, we're going to need to look at the agreements again when they come out. I mean, I think there is real imperative now on the WHO and on our own government to make the final draft of this document available. I think the lack of transparency about this process has shocked many of us. I think it has fueled theories that probably our government has thought have been unhelpful, but very, you know, legitimate, I would say. As the document stands, no, the WHO is not going to be able to issue binding power over our our government. You know, let's be clear, though, this is an international agreement. There are binding obligations in it. So we shouldn't be signing it unless we are happy in, you know, it's strengthening to an extent our health architecture and having the WHO continue to play a pivotal role in that. And I think many of us would question whether that is appropriate. But this idea that the WHO is going to be making rules and issuing laws which the UK has to comply with and which it doesn't have notice of now, no, that can't happen under the document now.
Well, see, now that is phenomenal. That is absolutely a win, because that, I think, was one of the major points that concerned people so desperately, this idea that we would lose our sort of national sovereignty and it would be given over to this centralised power. And so there is something good to be taken from it. I absolutely agree with you. We always have to be cautious with these things. I know we do. But, you know, the fact is that were it not for pushback from people like yourself, us for them and others, we would be now trundling down the road, wouldn't we? Because we weren't going to get pushback from legacy media on this.
No, I mean, I honestly, when I first looked at the documents a year and a half ago, and us for them, you know, put together quite a comprehensive legal briefing, note our background is, well, we are lawyers, I was appalled that this could be suggested to me. And, you know, it's a whole different conversation, but, you know, it bore the hallmarks of a type of international medicalized fascism, is the way I would describe it. I do not believe that is an overstatement. It may have been well intentioned. I am not, you know, reading mal intent. Other people, I'm sure, will do that. But it gave such huge and terrifying powers to a desperately conflicted organization, worse than that, actually, an individual within that organization. It seemed almost inconceivable that this had got off the table. So I think it is a huge win. I think we should think about how collectively we leverage that win and bring about the reform that quite clearly is needed of this organization. And if it won't reform, if it can't reform, if it is not able to fund itself without, you know, this very significant money from private interests, then I think there's a real question about the appropriateness of the UK's continued membership of the organization.
Thank you, Molly. I think we will take that as a win. And the reason I say we will take that as a win is very simple. And that is, at least you stop the train on its tracks. You know, as well as I do, the hardest thing is not necessarily stopping something. It's getting something to reverse once it's already in motion. Yeah. So I think you've done a tremendous job. Well done, everybody. Molly Kingsley, for us, from us, for them. We will be right back.
Thank you.
News.
There is a difference.
What's on the schedule for today?
A little less yappity yap and a little more
news.
Yay!
Now, TNT Radio News.
Matt Boylan here with a look at your TNT headlines. 18 of Donald Trump's allies have been indicted by a grand jury in Arizona for legally challenging the results of the 2020 election. The bishop stabbed in last week's alleged terrorist attack in Sydney has weighed in on the censorship war brewing in Australia. And as protests erupt across America demanding an end to the war in Gaza, demonstrators have swarmed the residence of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk.
TNT Radio.
TNT Radio.
And a reminder of our question of the day. After Labour vows to renationalise most rail services within 5 years, we ask, what other services would you like to see under state control? And the comments are coming in thick and fast, as you would expect. Bill Cruz on X says, it's gone. It's absolutely gone. Sorry, there's been so many. Bill, I'm sorry. Yeah, we need basic state provision of all essentials, really. Water, power, broadband, etc. And healthcare needs to stay under state control. There is actually a swear word there. That idiot streeting. I got you, Bill. I hear you loud and clear. Did anybody see the five military horses, some blooded, rampaging through England's capital city yesterday? It's freaked out the internet. Good and proper. Horsemen of the apocalypse, many people are saying. Several of those horses ran for 6 miles. They're apparently now back at the Chelsea barracks being healed. It was absolutely horrible stuff to witness. Horrible. One horse ran into a bus, another into a shop window. I'm sure we've got some pictures to show you. People were injured. Horses were startled after an industrial lorry frightened them. There they are. Look at that. Just horrendous. And it was very eerie and creepy. Some people thought it was a film movie set as well. But thankfully, they're okay. But lots of people are saying, uh-oh, this is it. End times are here. No, they're not. Absolutely not. You can't have end times. No. We can't be having any of that. None of that at all. Right. Let me welcome in my next guest. Oh, I'm very much looking forward to this one. With the London mayoral election only a week away, we thought it might be an idea to get a feel for what the people of London are thinking ahead of going to the polls. And who better to do that than a traditional London cabbie? With his thoughts on the issues that Londoners care about, I'm joined by Steve McNamara. You're a black cab driver, Steve. You're secretary of the Licensed Taxi Drivers Association. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Good to have you with us. Ahead of the election, what are the issues that you and your members are most concerned about?
Well, you've just hit on one of the issues. When you spoke about the horses that are running across London yesterday, well, they're probably the only thing that is running across London because the traffic is absolutely horrendous. The road network has been restricted. Nothing moves. The average speed of traffic in London is 8 miles an hour. Many of the roads are now closed. We've got a plethora of cycle lanes that nobody uses. And yeah, that is the major issue to our members. It is road access.
What, Steve, are you actually telling me that ULEZ has not improved the issue?
Well, ULEZ certainly hasn't improved the traffic. The congestion charge... We've got more than one charge in London, as you know. We've got the congestion charge and the ULEZ. The congestion charge was designed to reduce the level of traffic, but in reality, it's just become another tax and people just pay it. If you've got to drive, you just pay it. The ULEZ only affects vehicles that are not Euro 6 or EV. More and more vehicles in London now are electric. But the reality is, as far as we're concerned, the big issue is just simply the traffic. You cannot move around and it's getting worse by the day.
That's absolutely mad. Steve, some of the best journeys that I've ever taken have been in the back of a black cab because, you know, if you get the right black cabbie, right, you can have a brilliant conversation about everything. OK, so what we're interested to know is what do you find are the issues that concern some of the people that get in the back of your cab?
The biggest issue in London at the moment for the public, other than the fact they're sitting in the back of a cab and not going anywhere, the big issue for them is undoubtedly crime. Crime is a major, major concern in London. The Metropolitan Police have got more policemen than they've ever had. They've got 34,000 policemen. And I've got more chance of seeing one on here than I have on the streets of London. And unfortunately, street crime, phone snatches are running at 1,000 a day now in London. Oof. And crime is a major, major issue.
I mean, that's interesting. You say that we have more police than ever before, because obviously we've shut stations. We had reduced crime. We had reduced police numbers under Boris Johnson. So Sadiq Khan has increased the police.
Now, what happened? The numbers under Boris went down, I think, to 32 or 33. I'm not particularly clear on the numbers. But in recent years, the numbers have peaked at about 33, 34,000. That's what they are currently. But the reality is the commissioner, the current commissioner is, I say the current commissioner, he may not be the commissioner for much longer. He's under enormous pressure at the moment. We've got all these demonstrations every weekend in London, you know, pro-Israel, pro-Palestine, and that obviously takes up a lot of police resource. But the truth is the police are in special measures. The Home Office have put them in special measures in London. One of the reasons they're in special measures is for priorities. They don't prioritise the right crimes. And as I said to you, my members, the only policemen they ever see are invariably hiding behind speed guns, trying to catch somebody driving at 24 mile an hour in a 20. And you'll drive 200 or 300 yards up the road and someone's having their phone snatched. So that is a major issue to Londoners and people are becoming quite angry over it.
It's very upsetting. So I presume that the crimes that they talk about is not just like the snatching, but obviously knife crime is absolutely a major issue for us in our city, isn't it?
It's completely across the country, but equally in London, as you see. I mean, there was a video doing the rounds yesterday of a traffic incident in the Edgware Road, and which is a few hundred yards from Marble Arch, you know, right Oxford Street, right in the centre. and there's a bit of a dispute. And of course, obviously, the first thing you do is go to the boot and get your machete out. And there's a machete fight in Edgware Road at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It's unfortunately those sorts of incidents are not even newsworthy anymore. And it's a concern to many, many Londoners.
It's shocking. It's horrifying. Now, the thing that I know about Black Cab is you are sort of known all over the world because of your thorough training. Do you still have to do the knowledge?
Yes, we do. The knowledge is an integral part of driving a cab in London. I mean, one of the questions I'm asked frequently is it still needed? You know, we've got SatNav, we've got Waze, we've got Google Maps. And all of that stuff's absolutely fantastic until somebody jumps in at a set of lights and says, you know, something like Phillimore Gardens. Well, if you don't know how to spell it and you've got no idea where it is, by the time you put it in Google Maps, you've gone the wrong way and it takes you 25 minutes to get back to where you were. So if anything, because of the traffic, knowing your way around has become more essential than ever.
I mean, that is the thing, is that it's such a familiar sight, obviously, in our capital city. But then, of course, you had the advent of Uber. How has Uber impacted our black cabs?
Uber had a massive impact on us 2014, 2015. I mean, we were absolutely decimated. And the reason for that, and it was the same in Australia, the reason for that is that venture capitalists were pumping money in and Uber was subsidising rides to a state where, you know, you could get an Uber to go, you know, 2 or 3 miles in London at 3 o'clock in the morning for a fiver. You know, it's completely uneconomic, completely unsustainable. And of course, what's happened now is the VCs have stopped pumping the money in. As a result of that, their prices are now often way above ours. And it's no longer the economic choice. The only reason people chose to get an Uber, never mind what they used to tell you, the reason they chose it is because it was dirt cheap. And now it's no longer dirt cheap. They've just become just another minicab firm in London. And they no longer have the cachet or the, the sort of sexiness. Oh, look, I've got an app. Well,
yeah.
So
it was a bait
else.
And switch. It was a bait and switch, wasn't it? But the thing is, for the most part, we have a trust in our black cab drivers. We simply do. It's almost like, you know, a fourth service. And that is a reality. And I don't think Uber has ever kind of gained that level of trust from people that black cabbies do.
Yeah, and there's a very good reason for that. Their safety record's been absolutely dire. They've been refused a license twice by TfL. You know, there's legions of stories and reasons they were refused licenses is, you know, the vehicles were uninsured, drivers were unchecked. The driver you were getting wasn't the guy who had a license. It was someone's brother or uncle. And as a result of that, to be fair to TfL, they came down on like a ton of bricks, Transport for London. They revoked their license on more than one occasion. And as a result of that, you know, Uber now basically have to follow the game like everybody else. And as a result of that, they're no longer cheap. They're no longer particularly attractive. And for the same money as you squeeze into the back of a Prius with somebody who doesn't know where he's going, you can get in a black cab. And as a result of that, we're doing really well. These new electric cabs we've got, you know, these 65% of our fleet is now electric. We've got these fantastic new vehicles with the, you know, with a panoramic roof and, you know, all the hearing aid loops and disability access and all of that. And people love them. And as a result of that, we're doing very well. We're busier than we've ever been. And, you know, we've come back with a vengeance. And, you know, to answer your question, finally, Uber is just nothing more than an inconvenience to us now. They clog up the streets and the only time you see is coming down the wrong way down a one-way street. You know, that's the inconvenience to us.
Right. Steve, before you leave us, we're 1 week away from the mayoral elections. As we said, any idea from your customers who Londoners may be voting for primarily?
Yeah, well, that's a really interesting question because the polls keep telling us that Sadiq Khan is massively in the lead and it's virtually a one-horse race. Sadiq is not as confident because he keeps telling Londoners at every opportunity that they either vote for him or Susan Hall. Voting Liberal, Green or anything else is not an option, is what he tells them. But, you know, talking to people in the cab and you talk to people in the suburbs out of the centre of London, it's not such a clear-cut race. I think on balance, Sadiq is going to win. But if he does, he's going to be of a very much reduced majority.
Oh, I don't want to hear that, Steve. Everything was going so nicely between us and you've just finished it on a terrible note. I'm kidding. Thank you so much, Steve. This, everybody, this is Steve McNamara. He's a black cab driver and a general secretary of the Licensed Taxi Drivers Association. Have a great Thursday, Steve. Thank you so much. We will be right back.
Sometimes a car comes along that changes everything. with innovations never thought possible and features that make you wonder, how did people survive without this? This is that time, and this is that car. This is the world's first VW. Equipped with transparent doors to eliminate reasonable suspicion, whatever that means. A 10-2 steering wheel that keeps hands visible at all times. We remove the glove box so there's no confusion about what the driver is reaching for. With a touch of a button, the ultrasonic biometric scanner displays the license and registration of the driver to ensure contactless exchange of information. With no trunk, nothing can be concealed, so therefore, there is nothing to search and seize. To ensure you'll never be mistaken for breaking the speed limit, we've installed limited edition airless tires. And we removed the engine because, honestly, why risk it? DWB, the first vehicle of its kind, where the safety feature is the car itself.
Isn't just fuel to live, it's fuel to grow. My family relied on public assistance to help provide meals for us. These meals fueled my involvement in theater and the arts as a child, which fostered my love for acting. The Feeding America network of food banks helps millions of people put food on the table. When people are fed, futures are nourished. Join the movement to end hunger, and together we can open endless possibilities for people to thrive. Visit feedingamerica.org/act now.
Live from London, you're with Sonia Poulton on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back. Michael Blowfield said, this cabbie for mayor, he would get my vote. Indeed. And of course, a reminder of our question of the day. And that is, we've asked, after Labour vows to renationalise most rail services within 5 years, we ask, what other services would you like to see under state control? And Charlie says, not that I believe a word they say, but hypothetically, all services, travel, postal, NHS services, utility, etc. This is one of those questions where lots of people have lots to say about it, including, presumably, my next guest. Now, I am delighted, joining me now for a roundup of some of the day's biggest stories, is Chairman of UKIP, Ben Walker. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning, Sonia. How are you?
Well, great, thank you. So obviously our question of the day is about renationalisation. Labour is now pledging, as you know, to renationalise most rail services within 5 years. Is this a vote winner for them?
Do you know what? I am really conflicted on this one because I think it probably kind of is. However, I mean, COVID, you know, we know COVID's been used kind of as a cloak here to do this, to carry this out. And the government are already doing this. So many of the rail services are already under government control. So this isn't really a change. It's not a step change. This is kind of a slow process, which has already been happening. And I worry, is this step change just another step forward to a bigger state? That's my feeling on it. Let's be honest. I mean, the services probably can't get any worse than they currently are. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the truth of the matter. It really is a mess. But I do think that this is a step forward for bigger government. And obviously, there's ongoing rail disputes over pay and conditions. So what are Labour going to do about that? Are they just going to roll over and accept those? So that just means more of a burden for the taxpayer. I don't know. It's early days with this one, I must admit.
It is a bit tricky, isn't it? Obviously, Labour are looking for those votes quite clearly, because on the same day, what we had was Rachel Reeves said that the next Labour government will be more pro-business than Tony Blair. This is a massive contradiction, isn't it?
It really is. And I think it's very easy to be a party in opposition and say things which aren't really held to account. And
right.
I think that's only starting to happen now with Labour. So some of the things they're saying, they're being asked questions. Well, you know, explain that. How is that going to work? So I think that they're going to find in very short order that they are going to be asked some pointed questions. And are they going to have the answers? I don't think they are. We live in a society now where politics is more about perception than it is policy. So a lot of these politicians don't have the answers. They just have the good slogans, the catchphrases and the graphics to go with it, basically.
Yeah, the problem is people have become so disenfranchised with politics, which is not necessarily what a chairman of a political party wants to hear. But I'm sure you're hearing that anyway, right?
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's completely true. And we find that all the time, you know, people that who sort of really believe in sort of our core aims and our policies and principles still find it hard to engage in politics because they're just so fed up. I mean, from top to bottom, our system is broken. We have a sort of a government and establishment which is eating itself from within. I mean, the whole situation is a mess, and I completely understand why people feel disenfranchised and removed from the whole process, because quite rightly they should do. It doesn't matter what they do, say, think, it really makes no difference.
Immigration is such a huge feature for the voting public. I mean, that is a reality. We've seen what the Conservatives have done. What sort of job do you think Labour will do on immigration and the sort of channel crossings as one example?
Well, I mean, in terms of the Labour government, not the Labour government, but maybe the one that's coming and the existing government, there's not
interesting,
really much.
Interesting slip up there, eh?
Yeah, I know. There's not really much in between. You could get a fag paper between these two.
Exactly.
They are social democrats responsive to the media. They don't really have policies or principles or core beliefs or long-term thinking. They just don't. So I do worry. I think that an incoming Labour government, if that's going to be what it is, I don't believe that's going to be any better than what we currently have. If anything, it's probably going to be worse because they're going to have to try and appease those people that they've made promises to, all the do-gooder lefties. So I don't think it's going to get any better. It's a problem that this country is going to face for some time until somebody comes along who has the balls and the political will to put things right.
Or the ovaries. Don't forget that. We live in that kind of world these days.
I'm so sorry.
No, not at all. That's okay. You'll be sent to HR, Ben. You will be sent to HR, right?
Well,
I'm kidding.
I could have ovaries myself. You wouldn't know, would you?
Oh, my God. He's taking us into a whole other area of problems. Ben, so I'm taking you across the headlines, of course, but we learned today that England is the worst in the world for underage drinking. We keep being told that the younger generation are turning away from alcohol, but clearly there's an issue here. What do you think has happened?
Well, I think it just goes into some of the things that we've been talking around already. There's pretty much a breakdown in society. In this country, we don't know what we are to be proud of, what we are to believe in. The state looks to control every element of our lives as much as it can, all of the time. And I think parenting is really bad, you know, because we don't really sort of have any values anymore as a country, or we're not allowed to have any. It just seems that everyone's kind of flapping around doing what they want, and parenting and families isn't a focus. And it's just incredibly crazy. And my son, who is 16, my middle son, he will have a drink now, but obviously it's controlled and it's with his parents. And what we're trying to do there is not say, hey, get out, have loads of fun, get drunk all the time, but it's to slowly introduce him to it in a controlled manner, you know, and that would be with a meal or with a couple of friends staying around at the house who can have a couple of drinks. But it's controlled. And that, to me, maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong, but it's me trying to parent in a way that I feel fit. I'm trying to expose him to these things that are around him in society, but in a controlled way. And I think that's really missing in society now with, I hate to do it. I hate to sort of go at people and slag them off. But yeah, our family values and the family unit and parenting in this country is pretty much in the bin.
So you're talking more about doing it like the French way, right? And that is obviously they have wine often at meal times, and it's very much part of the lifestyle. And what we have in England is we say, no, 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 you can't have that filthy alcohol. And then at 18, it's like, you know, go for it, fill your boots. And it's a terrible approach to things, isn't it, really? I did exactly the same as you, by the way. I know, I'm sure people will be completely disapproving, but from a very young age, when my daughter was, I don't know, like eight, I would say to her, do you want to try a little bit of this wine? She'd be like, oh, no, thank you. And she has a very decently moderate approach to drinking, I think, as a consequence of that, because it wasn't made into a big thing that she got when she was 18. Exactly your approach. And I think that's a good one. I think that's a way forward.
Well, I don't get many things right when it comes to being a dad, but I'm glad you agree with me on that one.
Well, they don't come with a manual. That's the problem, isn't it? We have to kind of make it up as we go along and hope for the best. Parenting is incredibly hard. It really is, without all the attendant problems. But I also think, in terms of the underage drinking, I'm wondering how much the last 4 years, all the COVID, the lockdowns, everything, all the things that have been imposed on people, together with modern day pressures that are already existing, I wonder how much that is contributing to that, because we're hearing so much about young people and their mental health state as a consequence of lockdowns.
I think that's true. I mean, if you look back over time, you know, we're touching on this the kind of trans debate again, I guess, but you know, when young people were struggling before, there was always some sort of abuse of something. It could be substances, it could be self-harm. Now it seems that if you feel that way and you're struggling with your mental health, then, well, you must be trans. So it's weird, isn't it, how kind of people direct us in certain ways. But yeah, everybody struggles. I mean, I do. You know, even recently, I've been so overwhelmed with work, and I thought, oh, what is this all about? I can't be dealing with this. And you feel weighted down with the pressures of the world. But yeah, there's nothing wrong with having a drink. I've got a bad habit with that as well. But you know, people are flapping around, and they need some direction. They need to believe in something, and I just don't think they do. And they're driven these days to believe in nothing. That's kind of where the government wants you to be, isn't it? Isn't it easier to control you in some ways when you don't have a core set of values, you don't believe in anything?
Yeah, absolutely. You will have nothing and you will be happy. And that kind of theory that we've heard a great deal about. So Joe Biden, he said that I can't even believe that I'm actually going to be talking about this with you. I find these amounts so gobsmacking. I just can't get my head around it. Joe Biden has said that a $95 billion aid bill for allies such as Ukraine, Israel and Taiwan will make the world a safer place. Do you share his optimism?
In all fairness, I think the USA without Sleepy Joe at the helm would make the world a safer place. That man is the epitome of what people who would say the deep state is. You know, that is a country that's kind of running itself with people that you don't know, you don't see. It's being run from within. And that man is just at the front. Now, I mean, The whole sort of foreign conflict thing is a really, really difficult kind of situation. I mean, Ukraine, I just feel now that there has to be some sort of agreement that's drawn there. I mean, I don't mean to offend any viewers or listeners or anything like that, but essentially the Ukraine is a Soviet rust bucket. I mean, what is that country? There are parts of it which are just nonsense, and there's some really nice parts of it, but there's got to be some proper agreement over that. And it doesn't help when you have organizations like the UN or the EU carrying out joint operations on the border of Russia in Ukraine just to get under the guy's skin. I mean, I just don't understand it. I mean, as far as I can see, and I could well be wrong, I am many, many times, but Ukraine is kind of defunct in itself. You know, it's a country that's cloaked in lies, you know, dodgy dealings. I worry about our continual kind of involvement and engagement with that country in particular. And the problem is that the longer that wars go on and they become this perpetual circle of conflict, they become the norm. And that then it's used as an excuse to say to people, well, that's why your fuel bills are high, or that's why we're taking Ukrainian migrants, or, you know, that's why this is this. And this is what happened. Again, it's just another tool of organized governments to control their populace. And I don't think we should be doing that anymore with Ukraine. Taiwan, same. But again, that's just, a sort of a fork in the stomach to the Chinese. I mean, Israel's a different matter. I feel that in some way Israel is carrying the flag in the fight against sort of radical Islam and sort of terrorism at the moment on their own. And I think all too often people forget why this started and the fact that there are still hostages being held and there is still no agreement.
But on both sides, though, Ben, hostages are being held on both sides, right?
No, that's true. But there has to be, like with all of these things, the longer it goes on, it gets normalized and it becomes the thing. And that's what I worry about. And the UK,
right.
and obviously Australia, we do not have the resources or the money or the will to carry on sort of bankrolling these things.
That's it, isn't it? Right there. Yeah. I think people are sick and tired of paying foreign aid. But sadly, that brings us to the end of our news review with you, Ben. This has been most entertaining. Me being politically homeless, I'm quite shocked I've been so entertained, Ben. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Welcome.
Thank you. It has been
Thank
a
you,
pleasure,
Sonia.
Everybody. Ben Walker, UKIP chairman. We will, of course, be back after the break. Have a great Thursday, Ben. See you shortly.